Hello and welcome back, everyone, to part two of my conversation with Dr. Sarah Carmichael. Sarah is a professor at Appalachian State University and the Department of Geological and Environmental Sciences. Last time, Sarah and I spoke briefly about her journey working on energy extraction issues in the Appalachians, her courses that impress upon students the importance of geoscience and policy, and a little bit about the science of organisms and how microbiology could actually help in the mining process. So I'd like to start our discussion today talking a little bit about the need to balance when we're talking about mining for these critical minerals in Appalachian communities. So communities have to decide between, again, the economic benefits and the environmental risks that could come from these companies operating in spaces where policymakers have very little understanding of these key issues. And so what I mean here is that it's almost not just that the demand for critical minerals is outpacing supply, but it's also outpacing slow policy action in the United States. And so if we don't approach this holistically from various fields and perspectives, companies may just end up using these policy loopholes and gaps to cut corners. And so are there any cases that you see this happening? And we talked about this in part one. What are some of those loopholes or gaps that are there? Maybe not intentionally, but it's just because at a federal level, there's no oversight on these issues.
Okay, so I think before I go down that sort of long meandering rabbit hole that about the federal policy, I do want to say that a lot of these rare earth element extraction techniques for waste material are still in development. They're very promising, but they are still in development, and they're receiving a lot of federal funding right now, particularly from the DOE in the last couple of years, but also with more recent initiatives since 2021. And so I think we don't yet know how some of these waste extraction techniques are going to affect local communities. I'm not sure that the mining companies themselves, I'm not sure how they would benefit from them because a lot of them have already gone bankrupt. But what you are seeing now is financiers, people from Wall Street, people who don't have ties to the community coming in to capitalize on this as an investment, essentially. One of the challenges with the Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act, or I'm going to call it SMACRA from now on, that was signed into law in 1977 due to sort of egregious problems with strip mining in the region. And one of the things that that law requires is that you reclaim the land when you are done mining it. And because in Appalachia, it's very hard to reclaim the land just based on the topography, you have either you are either required to sort of push the land back up into the what's called approximate original contour, or you can make a case to the government that you are going to use it for a higher or better use, so some sort of economic development. So that's only once you are done mining, you don't have any more permits left that you're trying to get for mining it. So if you rebrand yourself as a rare earth element mine, you can just kind of sit on those permits and not reclaim that area. Reclamation is very expensive. One of the things I'm concerned about is that you've got maybe two things going on. You've got outside investors coming in and these permit loopholes where you can just let a mine site sit without anybody doing anything to it to reclaim it or to mine it. And they're just waiting until, you know, the market looks good enough to start doing some of the rare earth element extraction techniques. And I think the technology is so new that we don't know what the answer to that is going to be yet. I would like to think that the politicians in the coalfield communities would be like, hey, this is something we need to be thinking about coming down the pike. Based on their previous interactions with coal companies, I don't really have a lot of hope for that. In North Carolina, we're doing lithium mining here, or we're trying to. And you don't have that same sort of politicians in the pockets of the mining companies at all. It's a very different dynamic and a lot more equitable yet fraught, I guess is the best way I can describe it. There's a lot more openness for the community to argue with these mining companies because those communities do not depend solely on the mining companies for their jobs and all the downstream jobs that come from that.
Well, I mean, that's a point well taken. I think it's really interesting. And, you know, I'm working on some stuff, you know, in the Congo, and I think land tenure issues is always a big thing. Does the community own their mineral rights? You know, what does that look like? And when they don't, or when these foreign companies come over and buy up the land and buy up all these mineral, you know, problems will ensue from there, because the government ends up having more allegiance to a foreign investor rather than a local community. And we see that in the Congo, but you see that it's kind of like a resource curse precursor or part of that. That perspective and comparison between North Carolina lithium to the rare earth and the coal fields is really interesting. I think an important point for people to understand. Again, this the complexity here, right? Of all these things. It's so complex. It's so difficult to get all these things together and do it right. And then you look at the timing where it's like, we need the metals now. It's like you put all those factors together and it's a recipe for a big problem if you don't bring everyone to the table and have a discussion. I think you also bring up a really good point about technology, and it's not quite there yet, that waiting see moment. I mean, I think all these federal funds, I've been watching the Biden administration putting in money and all these other agencies put in money, but a lot of it's just demos or different things, and it's not necessarily there. There's no promises yet. So that's still going to be years away before we even get to that point. But we don't even know if we have years in the supply chain bottlenecks that we're seeing.
And to be fair, it was being funded through, I think, the Department of Energy during Trump's presidency, too. So this isn't just a brand new thing. I mean, folks have been thinking about this for a long time, and the funding has been there. Oh, yeah. It's just been not talked about as much probably as it should be.
Oh, no, I definitely think that one of the positive things about this, I think mining companies are recognizing this, or at least people in this field are recognizing that it's a pretty bipartisan issue, whether or not the communities that are voters are recognizing that. I think it's going to continue to be on a point of any administration after is going to continue to look at the critical minerals problem.
Can I add on to that just briefly? You note that it's bipartisan in Washington, D.C., pro mining for this stuff. It's also bipartisan at the local level to be anti-mining. Either through because you are an environmentalist or because of property rights issues, and you have some strange bedfellows at every level that are bipartisan, pro and anti. So it's one of the more fascinating dynamics that I've seen, and it's really different than what it used to be, I think.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I remember working with local communities on the Mountain Valley Pipeline, and I was always astonished. And the height of political tension in this country to see both sides of the aisle of the public, right, of the voters coming together against mining, against energy extraction. And I just thought that was fascinating because, you know, when you see both sides coming together against something like that, it's just there's a lot of questions that need to be asked from a policy, but in a mining company perspective, because that's a big problem. And that NIMBYism, it seems to be NIMBY from multiple perspectives.
It's really frustrating with students too, because they're coming and they're like, we need more renewables off of fossil fuels. This is our future at stake. And I'm like, yes. And these require mining of some sort. And they're like, not in the United States. And I'm like, so you're going to outsource your pollution to places that don't have these laws? And a lot of them just refuse to make that leap to be like, yeah, I guess that's what I'm doing. Like, let's outsource it to Congo. Let's outsource this to Indonesia or Bolivia or wherever, where there might not be as robust environmental protections. And I'm like, okay, like live with that then. I mean, it's hard for me as a professor. I can't indoctrinate them one way or another, but I do want to get them to think about like, what is it that you're actually saying here? Like, you can't say that you're pro-human rights in other countries and then be like, who cares when it comes to mining? Who cares, you know?
Awareness is critical right now. And I think that's the job of you as a professor and the job of what I do with this podcast or with other things. You know, the timing is not perfect and we need a lot of these metals now. And I think there's going to be issues that will arise. But the more that we put it out there, the more that we have these conversations, the more we teach people about it, the better. And I know that there's been so many people in my school that after I speak with them, they first meet me and they're very anti-mining, anti-minerals. And at the end of knowing me, they have a little bit more of a balanced perspective of, well, wait a minute, I need to realize that everything I'm talking about requires mineral resources. And like that, if that is what you can get out of a semester of people, then that's perfect, yeah. Right? Like you can't ask for a soul reversal of their ideals, but you can ask for an understanding of, wait a minute, I need to think critically about where I get my stuff from.
And one of the things that's powerful too is that you have students who will never be scientists. They don't want to, but they might want to be a journalist. They might want to have something to do with politics. They may want to do something like just be like an investigative forensic accountant or something. But like one of the things I tell them is you have a role to play. The scientists are a lot of times crap communicators about what we do. And I mean, this is, you know, just as much a dig on myself. So we need the science communicators coming in. We need all of these people doing all of these different aspects of the critical minerals conversation. It can't just be the scientists.
As a professor, you know, we're talking about what students need to be thinking about or some of these key things. So what do you try to tell students to impress upon them that they can be an actor in this bigger discussion, societal issues around mining, whether if they're a geologist or a journalist or something? Like, what do you think is important for a student to know or to take away?
Local journalism about what's going on the ground. And that's harder and harder to find now. But I'm totally self-taught about this. Like, nobody ever taught me about energy extraction in Appalachia, and now I teach about it. Like, I've had to learn it all myself, and we update the class every single year. And it's all based on publicly available reporting. And I'm not special. I'm not doing anything like that's super complicated or weird in this class. Yeah, I studied manganese oxides, but most part I don't work with acid mine drainage. I want students to know that they are not powerless in this, but they need to pick their battles. If you're gonna go into, I'm gonna make a dig at, there's a group that's no longer active, but they were an anti-mountaintop removal group back in the mid-aughts. And they would come into coalfields communities and be doing like guerrilla street theater and all this like stuff that was really alienating to the community and being pretty condescending and stuff, and be like, we just need to get the community to organize. And it's like, you are in the birthplace of labor organization and you're being a total jerk about it, you know? And I know that people feel strongly, but they have to pick their battles and pick a skill set that will hold up in a court of law. They're boring skills. They're not glamorous. They're not going to get you put in jail for doing like tree sitting or whatever. And students don't always want to hear that. They want to be out at a protest doing something that they think is activism. That's kind of, you know, shooting yourself in the foot here. You're just making people angry at you and you're not helping the cause.
In the past, some of those other tactics and shock and awe methods worked in certain things, and whether or not they worked long term, maybe in a short term it stopped something or it changed. But I think long term speaking, and I think too, if you want to enact long term change or you want to try to get a point that is kind of going to be impressed upon the community after you leave that area, then I think you need to build coalitions. You need to have those other skills as you talked about, because really the other ones aren't going to have any lasting impact. It's just going to get some news headlines, going to create some issues. But as I was talking to some companies before, you know, if the companies have enough money, they'll just lawyer up and go with it. You want that data. You need that if you're going to come in and make an argument. It makes it much more meaningful and impactful in the long term. And again, I think that we can all be important actors in this discussion. And I personally believe, and I've always believed, it's good to have debates. It's good to have these discussions. And it's good to have checks and balances, right? We live in a government where we have checks and balances.
Respect the community that you're in. In your tactics is essentially kind of where I'm getting at with this. And this is also true from, you know, the investors' angles as well. Respect the community that you're coming in to extract their materials, because they have been through a lot, especially in Appalachia. And you see that also not happening, you know, people in suits coming in from cities and looking, you know, talking down to folks who are local. And so I think there are multiple ways of being successful, but they take a long time and you need to be respectful.
So final question. So we always like to ask our guests this, given their diverse backgrounds, why do minerals matter?
I promise I'm going to boil it down to one sentence, but I have to tell you that I just came up with it like 2 weeks ago when I went to do the Explorers Club 50 little talk thing that I did. And I had to come up with a catchphrase to talk to non-geologists. And so tiny minerals tell big stories. And what you get at the molecular scale from a mineral or at the micron scale for a mineral shape tells you so much about how that mineral formed, what the presence or shape of that mineral might mean for, say, a mass extinction or for, say, sewage contamination in a cave system. Like, you can use tiny minerals to track that. And so that's why minerals matter. We don't think about the little ones that are invisible to the naked eye, but they tell the most important stories.
I like that. Tiny minerals tell big stories. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us on the podcast and discussing some of these very salient and critical issues that we're going to be facing in the years ahead. Until next time, I'm your host, Thomas Hale, and thanks for joining us on another insightful discussion on A Rock and a Hard Place.